Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, Preparing for Disaster in America, on Tuesday, May 7th, 2013. I'm your host, Joe Terry, and the South Bay Show is brought to you by Tapas and Vino. Located in the heart of Riviera Village, Tapas and Vino offers an idyllic location to meet and eat and has quickly become a favorite destination of local foodies. Opened in October 2011, this charming bistro offers an eclectic menu of small plates, salads, soups, and entrees for lunch and dinner daily. In addition, brunch is served every Saturday and Sunday with endless, yes, that's right, endless mimosas and bellinis. The popular outdoor patio boasts a vibrant scene each evening and features live music every Tuesday night. The extensive wine list offers varietals from regions around the globe, and brew enthusiasts will appreciate the comprehensive beer selection. Tapas and Vino also hosts monthly wine and or beer education events, provides off-premise catering, and has a private dining room for small groups. Tapas and Vino is currently running a Not Just Tapas and Vino campaign for listeners of the South Bay Show. Mention the South Bay Show or South Bay by Jackie and receive 25% off a lunch or Saturday and Sunday brunch entree. Be sure to visit the Tapas and Vino Facebook page for weekly specials and discounts. Tapas and Vino is located at 1729 South Catalina Avenue in Redondo Beach. For more information, visit the website at tapasyvino.com. That's T-A-P-A-S-Y-V-I-N-O. .com, Tapas y Vino, or call 310-791-8200. That's 310-791-8200. You can find out more about us on Facebook at facebook.com/The South Bay Show, or visit our website at thesouthbayshow.com. Preparing for disaster in America. This is a subject that can never be treated lightly, but we do our best to make it interesting, engaging, and yes, even entertaining to learn the few key skills and primary information that could save your life, your family's lives, that of a neighbor in a time of crisis, or the life of a treasured pet. Our mission is to engage hearts and minds and build knowledge and skills to help you prepare for whatever may come. This show is a true collaboration with solid roots in the community and a partnership with the Official Disaster Preparation Establishment. Our producer is the president of the local Manhattan Beach Community Emergency Response Team Association, Mr. George Butts. Hey, George, how are you doing today?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, listeners. I'm fine. Thank you.
Good morning. And, of course, with us today is owner, producer, writer of SouthBayByJackie.com, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today?
I am doing well this morning, Joe. Good morning, George.
Hey there.
That baritone. And of course, we have a wonderful guest today talking about a subject that we haven't actually covered directly, and that's exciting. Jackie, who's our guest today?
Our guest this morning is Mike Shunk, also known as Hazmat Mike. Mike's 27 years of firefighting experience cultivated his expertise as a first responder for hazardous material situations. As a hazardous material specialist, Mike has responded to numerous incidents for the Oakway Hazardous Materials Team, as well as being an executive board member for Oakland County, South Michigan. As a primary core instructor for the State of Michigan Hazardous Materials Training Center, Mike has created and delivered groundbreaking courses in an international forum. He instructs at facilities throughout the United States and Canada. His instruction also covers corporate entities, response organizations, and universities. Mike serves as adjunct faculty in higher education facilities throughout the state of Michigan in fire science, emergency management, occupational safety and health, and hazardous materials. His on-site response has mitigated all types of events throughout Michigan, Illinois, Ohio, Indiana, and West Virginia. Mike has also authored two books, Practical Hazmat and Practical Confined Space. They can be found on his website at www.hazmatmike.com. That's H-A-Z-M-A-T-M-I-K-E.com. Welcome to the program, Mike. We are so glad you could join us this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Joe, George, and Jackie.
Well, good morning, Mike. It's a pleasure to have you. And you know, I said that this is the first time we've had this subject, and it really is. I'm surprised, and it seems to me that it is the first time. George, Jackie, do you have – is that true?
It is. It's the first time we have specifically spoke of hazardous materials other than in the disaster preparedness portion for the general public, you know, how to recognize what to see, you know, isolate, make sure you take care of your own household chemicals and things like that. So, yeah, right. This is where we take the big jump into what has happened in Boston and what's happened in Texas. And I think just with those two words, we, you know, this is going to drive to where this show is going to go today.
Right. So we often think about, you know, hazardous materials in terms of chemical spills, or we think of hazardous materials in terms of, you know, the tanker trucks overturning or something like that on the freeway. Mike, let's start off by just having an overview, you know, of what it is, what is a hazardous material, and what are the sort of the different areas that you deal with and that our first responders deal with on a regular basis?
Well, the overall generic definition for hazardous materials is basically anything that causes harm to humans or the environment. Hmm. So you can appreciate that encompasses a very, very large scope of materials. And when you look at some of the recent incidents, they involve much more than packaged chemicals that are already transported. I mean, look at, for example, the incident in Arkansas where the gas shale line burst, and this material was literally running down the streets. I'm sure you've seen the video on that. Mm-hmm. In a cul-de-sac neighborhood. So the environmental people, who are the industrial and contract personnel on the hazardous materials end, that go into the second and third phase of remediation of a site after the emergency responders do, usually from the fire department, but sometimes from a larger police departments, they also may handle that depending upon the way the city's structured. It literally encompasses just about anything that can escape its container, whether that's intentional or whether that's through a terrorist action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is a great definition. Now, what do fire departments most often run into?
Well, fire departments primarily deal with the emergency aspect of a hazardous material spill. But it depends on the structure of the department. Some structures of departments will take the hazardous materials event to another phase and actually do containment and confinement of the material in a shippable container. Mm-hmm. Some departments that are closely linked with industrial folks may even on occasion transport the waste to a facility. It all depends on what they decide to adopt as their responsibility for the regulation. Once you get into what environmental companies do, where actually packages material in a shippable container and move it, there are a whole bunch of Superfund, SARA, and CERCLA issues that come up. So you don't see a lot of that in fire departments. Mm-hmm. Fire departments primarily take care of the immediate emergency,
and then
suppress vapors, and then begin through the process at that point.
Is there a separate team typically at the county level, or is that a state agency that comes in primarily to handle hazardous materials? I guess the mop-up and the cleanup certainly isn't done by the local fire department. They have to get back and get into position for the next emergency, right?
The way it's structured in Michigan is that there's two entities. There's local city fire departments that have usually a collective hazardous material team made up of fire members from neighboring communities. Mm-hmm. And then the next level up is what's called, at least in our neck of the woods, a regional response team. And that's a team that can be made up of those same people and many more members. Mm-hmm. That team is deployed by the governor. And that team can literally go anywhere in the state and on rare occasion has been known to cross state lines. Mm. So those people may be called from off duty. They may also be members that are on duty going to that particular scene. And then if anyone that is on duty is taken out of a place off of a fire engine or an ambulance, they will call in people from home to fill those spots within the department while that team member is at the site. That's usually how it's done.
I see. Right off the bat, I want to make sure I give out the phone number because this subject is something that people deal with potentially all the time, and they may have questions. And, of course, we have these hazardous materials roundups around the country where local governments and county agencies have these roundups where people can just drive through and drop off paint and turpentine and other kinds of hazardous materials that they just have laying around in the shed or the garage. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, and then we're going to talk about Texas, absolutely, and what happened there. But if you want to talk with Hazmat Mike, or give him a call and ask a question, please give us a call at 714-242-5288. That's 714-242-5288. I'll try to keep an eye on the switchboard so we can get to your comment or question quickly. Okay, so I guess, Mike, now's the time. Let's talk a little bit about Texas. Have you studied the situation there and what happened there?
Yes, I have. I haven't seen the final report yet.
Sure,
from any of the entities, but
you know more than we do. So start at the beginning. What happened?
Well, it started many years ago. While that company was getting formulated, and I don't mean in terms of the actual structure or what the people at that facility particularly did, but if you look at the visual pictures of what happened and the location of the buildings, you know one thing for sure. All of those buildings weren't constructed at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular situation, it looks like the fertilizer plant was in that location for a very, very long time and probably one of the main employers for everyone in that city.
Yeah.
However, what started it was the simple management concept of city planning. The idea that you would put different structures such as a retirement home, an apartment building, a school. I mean, you're killing me.
Yeah.
that close.
Yeah.
With a structure like that is very, very poor city planning.
Right.
You've heard the pundits speak over and over again on the political ends about the regulation issues. That is a big problem. The fact that regulation is down to catch these problems as they arise, such as these people storing way, way, way too much explosive material in the facility they should, is an issue. But, you know, when you look at the bigger picture, we're really looking at ethics here.
Mm-hmm.
Those people in the plant, or at least the ones that were running the plant, knew they had too much material there. They knew it was explosive. They knew that it possibly could be a problem. And the bottom line is that everyone along the way that deals with hazardous materials in whatever way, shape, or form, whether it's response or production of, mm-hmm. has to take responsibility for what they do. There's mm-hmm. there's a huge situation where you start dealing or handling a material that's potentially dangerous, you need to have a whole infrastructure set up for all the what ifs,
right.
that kind of a scenario.
Right.
As to the actual cause, the jury isn't in on that yet, but that material is, needless to say, unstable. And I think one of the quotes from the news media, whether or not it's true, I have no idea, but they had somewhere in the neighborhoods of over 13,500 times the legal amount.
Really?
Yeah, something like that. And, of course, the news may have expanded that, but any amount over the legal amount for that facility to contain is a very simple safety violation. And whoever was in the supreme command of that operation more than likely knew that and opted not to be responsible.
So I'm going to ask you some detailed questions about, you know, the chemical nature of what they were making, and this essentially was the same kind of bomb or explosion that brought down the federal building in Oklahoma, fuel oil and fertilizer, right?
Right, ammonium nitrate. Yeah, that,
ammonium nitrate.
That's also referred to in the trade as ANFO, ammonium nitrate and fuel oil mixed together.
Okay.
That's when those are ignited by some device, they become extremely expansive very, very quick to the point of detonation, which is actually different than an explosion because a detonation is faster.
Right.
And, of course, creates more damage.
Right.
It's a very, very good fertilizer, and it's used widely throughout the farming industry.
Right.
But it also is used for munitions as an explosive for certain types of munitions. So you've got a great chemical that has a dual benefit, but in both cases, it's a very dangerous material and needs to be dealt with seriously.
Right. We've had one of the safest previous 12 months or previous 18 months or whatever, safest periods on record in terms of aviation. And several commentators have said, well, this has nothing to do with planes. This has nothing to do with aerodynamics, or this has nothing to do with weather or anything else. All the hazards to aviation are all still there. What this has to do with is that we're finally getting a handle on international communication. Now, there have been some spectacular crashes. The one in Russia was pretty spectacular in the last 18 months. But we're getting a handle on human communication. Most airline disasters are a series of human failures that occur in succession, all in the same situation, that if just one of them were not present, or one person had asked the question or inspected what they should have, when they should have, the crash would never have occurred. So you're saying basically that this situation was human error. It was not a valve or a failure or some act of God. It was people basically being stupid and storing too much stuff when they knew they shouldn't.
I think that's highly likely, yes. Again, the final report is now, but it's highly likely. If you look at, for example, the disaster that happened down in Texas City, Texas, in the 50s, where the entire town was leveled, involving ammonium nitrate in a ship hold, the entire situation began from a small fire aboard ship, which heated this material to its explosive temperature from what they believe was a worker, probably there for in the middle of the day or in the morning when it occurred overnight after a long shift, threw a cigarette butt in the hold.
Just
now,
simple as that.
Did that particular individual, both then or whatever happened recently, know that practice was wrong? Very certainly today they did. Possibly they did back then. But, you know, people are working longer hours, and you get a sense of complacency. Right. When you're working around chemicals, you get tired, you want to take a break. I mean, the kinds of spills that we've gone on at fixed shipping facilities where they transfer containers from a dock to a truck and then take it to another location.
Mm-hmm.
95% of the time, those always come in to the alarm system or to our environmental company at 4:30 in the afternoon on Friday. Guess why?
Why?
Everybody's trying to get out of there. You know, it's late. They want to start the weekend, and boom, they drive a high-low blade through a drum, and it starts leaking all over the dock. 95% of the time, 4:30 in the afternoon, if a call comes in, you can almost tell them where it is. It's incredible. So
that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's a big issue. It's difficult. The longer people work and the laxer that safety protocols are looked at and taken in these industries, the workers then become, well, they're not yelling at me about wearing my safety glasses or smoking around the ammonium nitrate, so I guess I can do it now. That kind of a thing.
That's interesting that you going back to what you said at first about it, not enough regulations, and what Joe was saying about human error. But listening to you, this human error goes back as far as the fact that that plant had been there first before anything else, and yet
the town built around it.
Yeah, city officials allowed them to build these structures around it.
Exactly. You know, Jackie, that's exactly where the regulation, the Hazwoper and SARA regulations came from. About building close to facilities came from the 70s event in Bhopal, India. Where all people were killed was because most of them were living in small shacks right outside the fence line.
Right.
And this material began to leak in the middle of the night and just permeated right across the field and right through the fences and killed, I can't even remember how many, but I believe it was over 1,000, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, my God. Look, over 500,000 people were exposed.
Yeah, and they were much more injured, right?
Gas.
Yeah. Right, way more injured.
Yeah, we forgot to tell you that Joe spends a lot of time on the internet.
Yeah,
there.
Google's
that's
my friend.
That's good. That's and, good. I need remembrance.
immediate death toll 2,200.
Yeah.
Immediate.
Yeah,
death.
But you know, here's the thing. I'm not even going to get into the fact that me, Joe, and George are surrounded by oil refineries, right? But we also see this. In all these other natural disasters where people are allowed to build homes, where you have no business building homes in flood zones and fire zones and canyons. I mean, these are all, as far as I'm concerned, these are all failures of any type of regulate. Nobody's regulating this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, every time there's a disaster and, you know, we get that 100-year flood, but yet people were allowed to build on it 30 years ago or 50 years ago or something.
And, well, and how many of them have done this at least twice?
Oh yeah. They insist on rebuilding. You know, how did they get permission to build in the first place? You know, we got that Palos Verdes slump where the earth is constantly moving,
mm-hmm.
and yet people are allowed to build there.
Yeah, that's you know, in California, one of the limited things I know about some fire issues in California, which you always have every year from the Santa Ana winds. Mm-hmm. One of the key issues with that is that the majority up in the hills. Where these larger homes are that are affected, one of the biggest issues is building water retainment up there, because as of the last I heard, that water was all supplied to the fire hydrant system electrically by pump. So basically, you burn through one power line and all your hydrant pressure is gone.
Yeah,
and those people are stranded. So, you know, and it goes back to the ethics of responsibility. People who are planning this or trying to correct a situation that needs to be dealt with need to look, you know, we need to do this. Otherwise, every single year, the hills of California are going to burn down.
Yeah,
we just dealt with that last week.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, huge.
And we won't dwell on this, but a lot of our problem out here is that people will not let us mitigate our problem over the years. Mm-hmm. We can't do any controlled burns. We can't cut down our low brush. We have to leave it environmentally. And it always will result in a fire such that we've had this last week or so. And it takes additional resources. You know, the big trees would not have burnt down had the foliage underneath them been cut down or at least allowed to burn a long time ago. All right, enough of that.
Well,
personal opinion.
Yeah, no, but that's very true because in all cases, in all of these cases, groups that are involved in this, whether it's the earth moving from a mudslide or a fire or a Texas fertilizer exposure, they have to look at what's called the benefit versus risk management model and decide whether enough, in this example, is it more beneficial, balanced against risk, to remove that dry grass and suffer a little bit environmentally to avoid burning down 150 houses and possibly hurting people, or is the environment more important than 150 houses and those people in it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, sooner or later, you've got to make a choice on your path. Yeah. You have to turn to the right or you have to turn to the left. So.
But, you know, Mike, when you get a serious environmentalist in the room, they will tell you that fire is a natural part of the ecosystem in these canyons and in a forest. Fire is as important to the life cycle of the bristlecone pine and many other pine trees as water and rain. The fire opens the cones that have dropped and dried over a period of years. It opens them and releases the seed. So fire is just, it's a human fear, but it's natural. And in this case, in and around movie stars' homes, it has to be controlled. It has to be done on a regular basis. It will eventually be allowed because otherwise people are going to lose their homes too regularly. So
yeah, you're absolutely correct. And the one of the ways in which you evolve that discussion forward, so it's for the benefit of everyone, not only the safety of the residents, but the environmentalists, is that you choose very carefully who you put in the room.
Yeah.
And the taxpayers.
And that's an element. Absolutely, that's an element. But you have to look at the environmental science in dealing with these issues, hazardous materials, whatever, not just a well-meaning group of people that really don't have the training or the knowledge behind them to make viable comments. That just kind of spins your wheels, so to speak, and you never get anywhere.
We're talking with Mike Shunk, Hazmat Mike, about all things hazardous and how to clean it up. And if you want to know more about that, you can always go to hazmatmike.com, hazmatmike.com. Great domain name there.
Thanks.
Excellent domain name. Hazmatmike.com. We are here if you want to call in and ask Mike a question. Fascinating topic, of course. Everyone's affected by this. Give us a call at 714-242-5288. And real quickly before the break, Mike, I have to ask you, what kinds of clients do you manage or are you attracting with your website? What kind of clients call up and say, hey, I got a problem, I need some advice, counseling, consulting? How does that work?
Well, my website started out and still is educational in nature for my aspiring hazardous materials students at the university. And it's really a collection. The people that I make contact with is a collection of just about anyone from industry and from the emergency response community that wants to look at or has issue with some particular aspect of possibly their response or their operation if it's an industrial folk, such as we'll get emails from hazardous materials teams. They'll have issues about decon. Mm-hmm. And then we'll talk about decon, which by the way, is exactly why I wrote the book Practical Hazmat, to encompass all those areas. So, I mean, I just got an email the other day about some NIOSH respiration issues in the industry workplace. And I've been speaking back and forth with this gentleman for a couple of days, getting into the finite details of not only regulation, but how it reads to the actual worker and how you have to read. You know, you can read a regulation, but you have to train yourself in the hazardous materials field to be able to read between the lines.
Right.
To really get a feel for what these people are talking about. And spending a lot of time while I was in the fire service on my off days working for environmental companies, and I still do consulting for them, mm-hmm. I have a wide range of all these different types of business activities and actually working in them. So that helps quite a bit.
So, Mike, what institution do you teach for?
I'm currently with Madonna University, which mm-hmm. is a college in Livonia, Michigan, mm-hmm. in the occupational safety and emergency management fields.
What are the names of the courses that you teach?
Well, I have a fire service hydraulics course, mm-hmm. Which obviously focuses on hydraulics. Hazardous Materials 2, mm-hmm. which we just finished. Just finished up this last semester. That is the EPA 16515, OSHA 1910-120 Hazardous Materials Technician course. Mm-hmm. And what I did with that was put it into collegiate week increments, mm-hmm. over a period of 80 hours. Mm-hmm. So rather than going all at once like firefighters do,
right.
IPS breaks it down into 3 to 4 hour increments once a week over the course of a semester. And the one course that we just started, I just finished writing and just started last night, matter of fact, was the Next Level Up, which not too many facilities offer, from the federal standards, Hazardous Materials Specialist, mm-hmm. which is deals with some of the elements, but it's much more on the top end. In other words, when someone comes to a site and there are major problems that are not going well, mm-hmm. they start looking for the hazardous materials specialist, and basically he has to have the answers, or at least suggestions.
Right. This is exciting. I want to get more into the educational aspect. We've been talking with educators, and I want to get in more into that, but we're going to take a break. And thank a sponsor. You're listening to, ladies and gentlemen, Hazmat Mike Shunk, and we're talking about hazardous materials. And Jackie, what sponsor do we want to thank?
Well, you know, Joe, it's never too early to begin planning your financial future. When it comes to protecting your assets and hard-earned dollars, you'll want experienced professionals with a proven track record and flawless reputation on your team. Briganti, Cameron, Waters & Strong, Certified Public Accountants and Consultants, is the largest full-service accounting firm in the South Bay, and they are dedicated to providing professional services of the highest quality. The partners are South Bay residents deeply committed to serving the communities where they live, work, and play. They support a variety of local nonprofit organizations such as Skate Park PV, Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy, the Torrance South Bay YMCA, Palos Verdes Rotary, and Pediatric Therapy Network, among others. BCWS prides itself on providing national accounting technical experience with the personal attention of a local company. This commitment to uphold high standards of excellence has proven key to their success and first-rate reputation. Their ultimate goal and reward is to see their clients achieve financial success as they define it, whether that means helping them to reduce their tax burden, assisting them with planning to ensure their financial security, succession planning, exit strategies, and wealth transfer. The partners and professionals of BCWS are committed to providing their clients with the expertise and guidance they need to reach their financial goals. Briganti Cameron Waters & Strong is dedicated to helping you navigate to financial success. For more information, you can call them at 310-542-0011 and get a free consultation, or visit the website at www.bcws.com.
Yes. So we've had George, if you can help me, Rodney Roberson is a professor in Maryland of professor
I can't remember.
George, you can?
REM, yeah, preparedness through recovery.
Yes.
You're talking about Rodney?
Yes, Rodney Roberson.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
He taught preparedness and emergency management courses, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now we have Mike teaching hazardous materials courses. Is this, Mike, do you know or do you track this? Is this a trend that's new and different that these courses are being taught at the college level now?
No, I don't think it's because of any current situation. I think it's because that training has changed from actually going on site to facilities, and moved into the university realm, and a lot of it has moved to online.
Right.
For distance educators, students are going, taking their education to get ready for work positions at multiple universities now. Gone are the days when you go to one campus or one site to do training and boom, you're done. Go ahead and look for a job. Now, these students are taking courses literally all over the world.
Right.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing how this online, but that's why you're seeing it in the university now, I think.
Okay. Okay. It's a very good thing because these jobs, the kinds of jobs that a hazardous materials specialist can get, vary widely. They can slot themselves into lots of different positions for different corporations. So it's a very flexible kind of skill to have. And that's wonderful. Bodes well for the economy and obviously bodes well for more companies and more individuals being prepared for hazardous materials. So let me ask you, what do you see as the number one sort of problem that the average American, let's go for the average American, the average household with 2.5 children, what are they exposed to, and how can they mitigate those exposures?
Well, there's a number of things that they are exposed to, and through the evolution of the industry, things have been getting better for them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues that you've heard of, and I, matter of fact, I think you folks in California were kind of ahead of everybody, was this whole concept of getting rid of mercury-laden thermometers.
Mm.
And the issue with mercury is, of course, when the thermometer breaks, you're exposed to it. And it, those of us that are older remember playing with that stuff when were little kids.
Oh,
so
yeah.
They go, how can all of a sudden that be something that can give us cancer or potentially kill us or damage our respiratory system? Well, the key to that is understanding the material. What happens to mercury is, in itself, it's not that environmentally harmful to an individual. But when you heat it above 68 degrees, it now becomes mercuric pentoxide, and you're breathing that in. So that's the issue. If there is a warm, if you live in a warm area or you live in a cold area like I do and you have a warm house, you break one of these devices open and immediately this material starts to vaporize.
Mercury vaporizes at 68 degrees Fahrenheit?
It begins to, yes.
Wow.
So one of the standard procedures for mercury cleanup is not only to ventilate the buildings and evacuate the people while you're cleaning it up, but immediately when you get on the scene, turn the furnace off or the air conditioner on. Cool it down inside the building, office, workplace, wherever, to eliminate the vaporization.
Right.
And now you have a almost non-vaporizing liquid / metal to deal with.
Right.
And it makes the hazard much less, and it makes it much more acute rather than spreading throughout the entire building.
Okay, I'm sorry. I have to cut in here. I got to ask you this. Okay, so mercury after 68 degrees Fahrenheit, it's danger above that temperature. And
it begins,
somebody decided to put this in something that you put in your mouth to take your temperature. All right. And humans are generally what, 98.6?
Yeah,
right.
Oh, okay, that all makes sense to me.
Yeah. Well, you got to remember, Jackie. You got to remember that originally, when this is a very, very old tool and medical device, way back when, this research wasn't known about mercury. Once the research was found out about these types of things that happen with mercury at elevated temperatures, they then began the process of, hey, we got to get rid of all the thermometers. Well, how do we do that? Well, we have to educate the people. Then we have to put up banners. Then we have to find a device that we can substitute that functions as well as a mercury thermometer does, and few do. Even the high-tech ones. That's the beauty of using mercury in a thermometer, because the device itself does function so well. The people in the homes are not going to say, well, wait a minute, you can't take away my thermometer if my little daughter or son gets sick without giving me something to replace it. So all that type of stuff takes time, right, and planning. And that actually is a good example of not knowing what the hazards were. Originally.
Okay, well, let me ask you something else. So these new thermometers, and I have one, it's like a digital readout.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have mercury in it?
No, none of the replacements do. That's a sensor device, and it does function well, but the medical people I speak to, and the ones that we use when I was still with the fire department, also as an emergency medical technician, they really weren't that accurate. So if you had a little one who had a real high temperature, you could get within the range, but it really wasn't exact. And that was a year or so ago. So I'm assuming each one that comes out is more and more accurate and better.
Okay, so one more question. I'm sorry I'm going off on this, but I'm realizing this. I have one of those little rubber ducky thermometers for my jacuzzi, and it's the old-fashioned one, you know, where the red line goes up. Is that mercury in my jacuzzi that I heat to 102 degrees?
You know, I'm not familiar with that device.
It's just it's a thermometer that you just leave in your pool or your jacuzzi that tells you how hot it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
but it's the old-fashioned kind.
Yeah, I'm gonna say that it is.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
But
yeah,
it's
because I have two of them. I have one in a jacuzzi and one in a in the swimming pool itself.
Right.
Yeah, our jacuzzis are always frozen, so we don't have to worry about it. It's like a block of ice.
Oh, boy. Okay.
For our listeners, I want to get back to maybe a little bit about Texas. And when we teach disaster preparedness to, you know, our general citizens, and we have this conversation under fire and safety, we talk about the triangle on the buildings. And if you ever go to a building, you know, as you don't see a lot, you as the general public probably do not see much of this, but as you look at vehicles and trucks driving down the road, you're always going to see some triangles on them with a variety of numbers, and they're going to tell you what it is that they're carrying and the degree of danger that they are. Mm-hmm. And also on a building, depending on the extent of what's in that building or on those premises, there is also going to be a triangle. And on the very bottom of that triangle, the bottom triangle of that triangle, it's going to be white. It's going to have a W there. And if there is a cross, you know, line through the W, it's telling you do not put any water on it. Mm. And I would never, you know, or want to, or put anything on those first responders and the volunteer firemen in Texas, in West Texas. But possibly, I wonder, you know, was it marked? It seemed that it was possibly the fire was roaring, but it didn't explode until after the firemen got there. And what's the possibilities that it may have actually exploded because water was put on it? Yeah. Mike, have you got anything?
Well, again, I would really hate to speculate on something like that until the final result comes out. But I do know that one of the major components of fighting fires when you are unable to use water as a primary agent is through the use of Class B foam. And so much so that not only did I write a couple programs about it, but I broke those programs up. And next month, I'm starting a 14-month series on firefighting foam on the website in a 14-month series of articles, because I feel that this particular tool is so important to the fire suppression. And the beauty of this tool is that you can not only use it to fight fires that are water sensitive or water reactive, but you can also use it on hazardous material spills for vapor suppression. Now, being able to use a tool that stops vapor suppression, in other words, a continued evolvement of toxic vapors right off the bat, removes a huge logistical issue of having to evacuate hundreds and hundreds of people, because you've eliminated that from the equation. So that frees up personnel, equipment, operational tactics. It's just absolutely wonderful. And the fact that more departments don't use firefighting foam as a main component, in other words, a main default position when water is not advised, is really, really unfortunate. And it's a darn shame, because the technology in this has existed before World War II, and it's successively gotten better right up until now. Now they even have environmentally what they call green foams, which will not only suppress all sorts of flammable liquid fires and hazardous material spills, but they have been found in independent tests to actually work well on Class D materials, which are water-reactive materials. And the fact of the matter is 97% of a firefighting foam line is water, and yet with just 3% of it being foam eliminates the reactivity of water-reactive materials. Of course, that has not been sanctified by the governing agencies yet, the Underwriter Laboratories or Factory Mutual as of now, but I'm sure it will be shortly. Mm-hmm. So it's just a wonderful tool.
Absolutely. Is it a cost issue, do you think, Mike, or is it just a training issue?
It's a little bit of both, but I'm not sure if there are state or federal subsidies for foam, but there are ways to purchase it more and more expensive. It's running about, last check, about $75 to $55 a gallon, and they sell them in 5-gallon pails. Right. So it's somewhat pricey.
Right.
But when you consider that you can literally use this tool to stop destruction, that cost becomes relatively low.
Mm-hmm.
Industrial companies who have to have foam monitors on flammable liquid tanks at refineries and things of that nature, they buy foam by the hundreds, the thousands of gallons. And oftentimes local fire departments can kind of get in on the purchase of foam with them through a co-op type deal, and that lessens the cost a bit. And training using that stuff is not super difficult, but it is practical, which means you need area, you need a time, you need manpower present, and you need some foam to actually use, so the operator gets a feel for what's going on and how it's when it's coming out proper.
Fascinating discussion. We're talking with Mike Schenk. We're Hazmat Mike. He's got a website that talks a lot about all these issues, hazmatmike.com, and we're going to come right back to him after we talk about what's coming up. And, George, what's coming up?
What's coming up? Coming up this coming weekend, on Saturday of this week, is our Manhattan Beach Police and Fire Open House at 10 a.m. Our police department will have their memorial service for their fallen members, which will be right across from the fire department at 15th and Valley. And then at 11, I'm sorry, and then at 9, at 10, no, I'm sorry, okay, here we go. At 10, it will start. At 11 o'clock, the open house at the police and fire. There'll be tours of the jail. The youngsters will be able to crawl on fire engines. There'll be some food and lots of entertainment. You'll learn about Neighborhood Watch. You can come learn about CERT and have a great time to come support both our police and our fire. On the 14th, next week, on the 14th at 6 p.m., there will be a budget meeting for the city, and they're going to talk about our police and fire departments and all those that are interested in supporting our police and fire are encouraged to attend and speak if you'd like. On 6-4, on the 4th, we are actually going to, that Tuesday, that will be, it's called Sidewalks CPR, and we, along with the fire department, will be wandering around the city. There may be some people collapsing as victims in the middle of the street and have somebody come. I'm not sure exactly how we're going to do it yet, but I'm sure we're going to be set up at the mall, and we're going to be teaching and showing people some hands-on first aid, hands only, a little bit of everything there. Our annual meeting and picnic for the Manhattan Beach CERT Association will be at Pollywog Park on June 8th. That Saturday, we're going to get together from 10 to 4. The fire department's going to cook out for us. We're going to have lots of games. The whole family's invited. Be a little bit of business. It'll be our annual meeting as well as the election of our board members. So we want all of our members to come and enjoy and have such a great time like we had this last year. And then on 6/22, on Saturday the 22nd of June, we will have our CPR AED training again at the Police and Fire Community Room, an AM class from 8 to noon, a PM class from 1 to 5. If anybody's interested, it's $45 for those two-year certificates. And my email is gbutts@mbcerta.org. If you want to participate in any of these, feel free to give me a shout-out. One last thing just came in, May 18th. Our Public Health Emergency Volunteers Network, which is part of L.A. County, has invited its registered partners, of which Manhattan Beach is one of, to a session from 8 till 3 in Long Beach. For information, give me a call. But in the morning, first off, we're going to talk about environmental health issues after a disaster 101, beginning safe water after a disaster, and then environmental health response and safe water. So that day, a full day of training put on by our county Department of Public Health Emergency Preparedness. And that's it for this week.
Okay.
I should just mention one thing. I am our class for tomorrow, our women's self-defense class, is canceled for tomorrow night.
That's why I didn't mention it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I just wanted to put that out there that it is canceled because I have to be someplace else. So okay. We'll resume next week.
Okay. Well, that's like saying don't forget when you really should say remember.
Okay.
Now, say what?
Well, you should never tell people. Yeah, right. Okay.
You're right. Yeah. You never tell them that what to do.
Exactly. Don't mention it if it's not like relevant. Just sort of go on. Mike, this has been a fascinating discussion. We really haven't talked about all the issues that we'd like to talk about. Of course, there is, Jackie just touched on it, and I will just echo that. Here in the South Bay of Los Angeles, one of the most beautiful places in the country, also one of the wealthiest places in the country. We have some very wealthy residents and some amazing, spectacular homes. But just less than, I would say less than 2 miles to the north is the Chevron refinery, which is one of the largest in the nation. And then to the south and the west is Mobil Oil Refinery, again, one of the largest in the nation. We're kind of surrounded by hazmat issues.
Let me jump in there just
please.
Real quick. I'm not sure what you mean by 2 miles to the north, but Rosecrans Avenue splits Manhattan Beach and the refinery.
Yeah.
But also, Chevron has its own fire department, its own hazmat.
Right.
If you drive down, it is literally the whole facility is built inside a large berm.
Right.
Other than some, and we've discussed this, some large clouds of toxic, you know, a plume of smoke
mm-hmm.
or material where one might be asked to either shelter in place or evacuate. Chevron, all in all, and they is quite safe.
Yeah.
We never want to take it for granted. But they, along with all of the fire departments around us, do train over there. So,
do they do the training, the kind of training that Mike was speaking of, where they actually use the foam and they?
I am sure that they do.
Right, of course. Right.
I'm sure that they do. I have not been to it, but I know that all of our surrounding fire departments have had. Training there, listening to the radio one day, I'm listening to what sounds like a real disaster over there, and actually found out it was an exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I was ready to call in and see if they needed any CERT members for triage or to handle the,
right.
the medic unit there, and then to find out it was discussed and communicated as being so real that if anybody that was listening would have thought it was.
So, George, can you briefly just talk about the Mobil Oil Refinery over on Crenshaw?
Crenshaw and South.
Crenshaw and 190th.
I certainly don't know as much about it.
Is it as much of a danger to us that live closer to the ocean because the prevailing wind is going east?
No, I would say no, it would not be.
Mm.
It would have to be in our case, for us in Manhattan Beach and Hermosa, maybe Redondo a little bit, but Torrance, an easterly, a wind out of the east might push it back, but all in all, we're in pretty good, you know, shape here, even in Manhattan Beach, with our ocean breezes. So,
right.
I wouldn't think that we would have a big problem unless it was a Santa Ana wind.
Right. So, Mike, this has been a fascinating discussion, and we just haven't gotten even, you know. Close to covering all the different things that hazmat encompasses. Are there any closing thoughts, things that we didn't mention that you'd like to mention to people out there listening?
Well, I think I can just round it back up by going back to what we originally started talking about. There's so many different aspects that involve hazardous materials, and the important main concept is if you work in an area that has these materials, try as best you possibly can not to get complacent. Make sure that you are doing exactly what the workplace orders. You wear your safety glasses, you report any leaks, things of that nature, because it's not so much the need for more regulation, it's the need for monitoring the regulation. In other words, actually inspecting that type of thing to prevent a lot of these catastrophes from happening.
Mm-hmm. So the word is we've had disasters. We have the regulations in place. Now, if only the people running these facilities would enforce the regulations and actually act on them. Things would be safer. In this case, with Texas, we didn't talk about Boston, so we can't do it justice. But in Texas, it was just really a matter of just too much material being stored in in a situation that was potentially dangerous. If it was less, the disaster would have been less.
Exactly. And again, that goes back to ethical responsibility.
Right. Thank you so much, Mike Shunk. Thank you very much for joining us. HazmatMike.com. Thank you, George.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, folks.
Bye-bye now. Take care, everybody.